You're listening to LGRadio.online. Welcome to In the Benny Green Archives.
It just so happens that this week's programme did take quite a bit of research, but only by accident. I started out in pursuit of a harmless creature called Earl Carroll, who was a sort of lesser Georgie White. And as Georgie White was a lesser Flo Ziegfeld, and Ziegfeld only stood 5 feet in his custom-built socks, this makes Earl Carroll practically invisible. Anyway, I started out to look a few facts up about Earl Carroll and was suddenly bowled over by a certain name in connection with one of his shows. So astonished was I by this name that I went off on a time-wasting tangent, and that's where the research came in. Now, the thing about research is that very often the longer it takes, the more useless is the information it discloses. After half a day of burrowing around, all I'm equipped to do that I wasn't equipped to do before is to set the following conundrum. What do Finlay Currie and Georges Carpentier have in common? Just to make it easier, let me say that whatever it is, it's the same as what Humphrey Bogart and Victor McGlagan have in common, to say nothing of Wallace Beery, John Wayne, and a lot of others. The answer is that they were all in Hollywood musicals, and not in very tiny parts either. John Wayne actually starred in one back in 1929, masquerading under the assumed name that he was born with, Marion Morrison. And then there was Lionel Atwill, who I always remember as the mad scientist whose laboratory is always bubbling and steaming while he manufactures a three-legged banana, or that most fabulous of all creatures, a conscience-stricken producer. Atwill actually was in a pre-war musical called The Great Waltz, all about Johann Strauss. I don't remember if Atwill actually meets Strauss in a picture, but judging on possibilities, I should think rather than meet him, Atwill built him out of a few odds and ends left lying around the laboratory. Now, what brings all this up is the fact that in 1933, Earl Carroll wrote and produced a Broadway show called Murder at the Vanities, starring Bela Lugosi, which would have given new meaning to the standard line of dialogue which the hero always says to the management, "What do you want, blood?" The trouble with all this is that precious few of Earl Carroll's shows, there were 16 of them, so much as raised a decent song. And we have to go right down to number 12, The Vanities of 1931, before we come to anything worth playing.
Good night, sweetheart, till we meet tomorrow. Good night, sweetheart, sleep will banish sorrow, tears and parting may make us forlorn, but with the dawn, a new day is born. Good night, sweetheart, though I'm not beside you. Good night, sweetheart, still my love will guide you. Dreams and when I'll hold you, good night, sweetheart, good night.
Good Night, Sweetheart, an English song written by Brighton's own Ray Noble. And it was the big hit of Earl Carroll's Vanities of 1931, or almost the big hit. The biggest hit of all was always the chorus line, which wore almost nothing with an air of heroic indifference to goose pimples. Now, whether Carroll knew the value of a good song, I doubt. If he had, he would have found more of them. But in 1932, a very good one did turn up in the Vanities, a song composed by young Harold Arlen with words by Ted Kohler. In the original production, I think it was sung by Lillian Roth. But the best version, musically speaking, is probably this one.
I don't care who knows I am blue. My son wouldn't take long to give my heart away. Play. my son. Couldn't belong to someone feeling gay. I got a right to sing the blues. I got a right. I got a right to hang around, down around the river. A certain man in this old town keeps dragging my poor heart around. All I see and cry down around the river. I know the deep blue sea will soon be calling me. It must be love, say what you choose. I got a right to sing the blues.
Fitzgerald, I Got a Right to Sing the Blues, with robust accompaniment from the Billy May Orchestra. And that really is the sum total of Earl Carroll's contribution to the musical register. His reviews were successful enough, he always employed a couple of big names each year, and used to invite excellent songwriters to work for him, but somehow when they got down to it, they were hardly ever up to it. For instance, one year the Vanities had songs by a man called Clarence Gaskill, an odd bird who became a vaudeville piano player when he was a mere child, and then became a teenage delinquent when he opened his own publishing company at 19. Then he went back into vaudeville as a solo act where they billed him as the Melody Monarch. It's a wonder nobody ever crowned him. One moment of glory had Clarence Gaskill. He wrote the greatest drunk song of all time, Sweet Adeline. the song that also had the best joke written about it. In one Marx Brothers saga, the mate reports to the captain of an ocean-going liner, I mean it's another kind, that although he can't locate the stowaways, he knows there are four of them. Why? Because they keep singing Sweet Adeline. Well, not being an habitual drunk myself, nor a stowaway, my favourite Gaskell song is quite a different one. Gaskell did a lot of things in his time. He published a book, for instance, called Memories of Vichy. During the First World War, his experience as a song publisher proved invaluable, and on the strength of it, he was made a machine gunner, and later won the Purple Heart. He had a hand in Cab Calloway's yodeling saga of Minnie the Moocher. But reverting back to music for a moment, here is the Gaskell song I used to love to play and which I now love to hear sung.
Your eyes are blue, your kisses too. I never knew what love could do. I can't believe that you're in love with me. You're telling everyone I know I'm on your mind each place you go. And they can't believe either that you're in love with me. Well, I have always placed you high above me. To think that I'm the lucky one. You see, I really can't believe that you're in love with me.
Best one by far that Clarence Gaskell ever composed, although he wrote more than 20 songs for Earl Carroll without remotely approaching that one. Now, although my journalistic instinct tells me that the best way to arrange things is to build conversational bridges between recordings, I don't see how I can build one at this stage. One of the many hobbies indulged in by Cole Porter was riding horses in the company of people whose pedigrees very often weren't as impressive as the ones the horses had. Anyway, one day on taking a fence, Porter was thrown by the horse and fell. Well, unfortunately, nobody else was in earshot, and Porter had to lie there till help came. The pain in his broken legs was too awful to think about, so he didn't think about it, but worked on a lyric instead. Eventually, he was found, taken home and operated on 20 or 30 times before he died, but never again was he quite free of pain from his damaged legs. Now, if the story is true, and we have no reason to believe it wasn't, then they rescued him fairly quickly, because one of the great drawbacks of this otherwise brilliant song is that there is no complete second set of lyrics. There is an uncompleted second set, but in the meantime, vocalists are limited to this.
Is it an earthquake or simply a shock? Is it the good turtle soup or merely the mop? Is it a cocktail, this feeling of joy? Or is what I feel the real McCoy? Is it for all time or simply love? Is it Granada I see or only Asbury Park? Is it a fancy not worth thinking of? Or is it at long last love? Is it for all time or simply a lark? Is it Granada I see or only Asbury Park? Is it a fancy not worth thinking of? Or is it at long last love? For all time or simply a lark? Is it Granada I see or only Asbury Park? Is it a fancy not worth thinking of? Or is it at long? Is it at long?
Long Last Love, the last song Cole Porter ever wrote before the accident that sundered his life, or rather, the song he wrote during that accident. The next song also has connotations with the medical profession, although a little less serious. In 1926, during the writing of the musical OK, the lyricist Ira Gershwin was suddenly smitten with a wayward appendix and was rushed to hospital, where he was operated on by some wayward doctors who were rash enough to try to stop Ira from working. When they finally let him go, it was with the strict instruction that he work only half days. And Ira, to his dismay, found that this was all he could manage anyway. So a friend dropped in and offered to help him by providing a few rhymes and odd lines. One of these odd lines turned out to be very useful to Ira, who instantly bagged it as a likely title. George wrote the melody, but he set it at a fast tempo for the chorus line to tap to. One night, feeling a little bit moody, George began playing the song slowly, at which Ira looked up and said, "That's the way it ought to be." Well, here's how it turned out. Amended tempo by George, lyrics by Ira, title by Howard Dietz, vocal by Lena Horne, saxophone obbligato by Phil Woods.
There's a saying old says that love is blind. Still we're often told, seek and ye shall find. So I'm going to seek a certain lad I've had in mind. Looking everywhere, haven't found him yet. He's the big affair I cannot forget. Only man I ever think of with regret. I'd like to add his initial to my monogram. Tell me, where is the shepherd for this lost lamb? There's a somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that he turns out to be someone who'll watch over me. Thank you. to my heart he carries the key. Tell him, please, to put on some speed. Follow my lead. Oh, how I need someone to watch over me.
Someone to Watch Over Me, Lena Horne with Phil Woods on saxophone supported by the Robert Farnon Orchestra. Here's one more example of Lena Horne's highly personal style, and this time there is no anecdotal information to add for the simple reason that I can find no documented evidence that the song exists at all. None of the reference books lists it, and even Duke Ellington does not include it in his list of hundreds and hundreds of compositions which form the appendix to his autobiography. Or is it the autobiography of his appendix? I suppose the man to ask will be Kermit Gull, who wrote the words. And yet even he is listed as having worked with Oscar Strauss, Walter Donaldson and Mabel Wayne. No Duke Ellington. And yet I'm not dreaming this. There is this song, and Lena Horne certainly sings it as though she believes it's there.
I wish I was back in my baby's arms. I wish I was back to stay. Every time I kissed him, I'd tell him how I missed him and promise I would never go away. Yes, I wish I was back in my baby's arms. I'd gladly take the blame. I'd wrap my blues in cellophane and put them on the shelf, and then I'd find a mirror and congratulate myself. Oh, I wish I was back in my baby's arms. And I wish my baby wished the same. I wish that I was back in baby's arms. I wish I was back to stay. Every time I kissed him, I'd tell him how promise I would never go away. I wish I was back in my baby's arms. Why, I'd gladly take the blame. I'd wrap my blues in cellophane, put them on the shelf, and then I'd find a mirror and congratulate myself. Yes, I wish I was back in baby's arms, and I wish my baby wished. Yes, I wish my baby wished the same.
Lena Horne singing one of Duke Ellington's several non-existent commercial songs, I Wish I Was Back in My Baby's Arms. July the 1st is a date worth a mention because it turns out to be the last one that a composer called Jay Gorney ever survived. Gorney was a much honoured man, Songwriters Hall of Fame, lots of citations for this and that, and yet the number of songs of his which have survived is tiny. My own feeling is that he wouldn't be remembered at all today were it not for the song he wrote with Yip Harburg in 1932, Brother Can You Spare a Dime? A friend of mine, an executive producer in the BBC, once asked Harburg if that was the first song of the Depression. To which Harburg, who was a bit of a wit, replied, "Listen, before we wrote that song, there was no Depression." Somebody once suggested to me that the partnership between Gorney and Harburg had the stuff of great romantic melodrama about it. When I asked for details, none were forthcoming, except that I was advised to think about Mr. and Mrs. John Ruskin and John Everett Millais. Now, Ruskin was the man whose wife left him for the painter who was doing his portrait. So we can all draw our own conclusions. Anyway, Gorney and Harburg certainly did break up the partnership at a very early stage. Now, there's one Gorney melody that I think deserves to survive. Lyrics by Sidney Clare. The year is 1934. And notice how the second line of the lyric is the first line of a famous Cole Porter song.
You're my thrill. You do something to me. You send chills right through me when I look at you, 'cause you're my thrill. You're my thrill. How my pulse increases, I just go to pieces when I look at you, 'cause you're my thrill. Nothing seems to matter. Here's my heart on a silver platter. Where's my will? Why this strange desire that keeps mounting higher when I look at you? I can't keep still. You're my thrill. Where's my will? Why this strange desire that keeps mounting higher? When I look at you, I can't keep still.
You're My Thrill, composed by Jay Gorney, who's one of those songwriters who stands a better chance of survival in, say, 100 years than a lot of better composers, simply because one of his songs, Brother Can You Spare a Dime, accidentally became social history, if you like. July the 4th is one of those dates which uncannily symbolises not just the birth pangs of the United States, but also those of two men who between them represent at least half of the traditions connected with the type of music I feature each week. One of these men is, of course, Louis Armstrong, maybe the most extraordinary and original genius that American music has so far produced. I say that because what he did was to invent almost single-handed a new kind of musical language. There were, of course, improvising musicians before him, but Louis was greater than any of them. Not only did he synthesize into his own style all the good things that they'd thought of, but he added qualities of his own which made him incomparable. Now, I think a convenient way to illustrate this is to feature Louis playing a so-so song. If he's doing Solitude or Lazy River, naturally he sounds at home because the material belongs to his world. But the amazing thing about Louis was his knack of using songs which frankly weren't up to his standards and endowing these songs with genuinely moving emotions. Now, this one coming up is not a bad song, but it's not terrific either. Words by Mitchell Parish, music by Stuff Smith, the great violinist, and also a man unknown to me with a wonderfully geographical name of Cameron Salter Wells. What do you do? Do you shake his hand or go there for a week's holiday? Now, in this recording, Louis sings the words, and it's not too bad. And then he plays a little bit of trumpet, and suddenly this song, which is called It's Wonderful, becomes just that.
It's wonderful to look into your eyes and realize you care a little bit. It's wonderful to know that you love me. It's glorious to feel that I'm a part of you, sweetheart. To share your happiness is marvelous. How lovely love can be. Oh, dream that I'd be allowed through the doorway of heaven. I'm drifting high on a cloud. You're an angel and this is heaven, mama. It's wonderful to have your lips divine combine with mine and dream forevermore. It's wonderful to know that you love me. Oh, babe, you love me too.
It's wonderful, and I think it really is wonderful how Louis Armstrong, in the span of a few bars, can elevate a modest little ditty like that, giving it an odd blend of serene melancholy and exuberance. Now, still on the subject of Louis, let me come now to that old brotherhood, the Rennes, Leon T. and Otis. Now, Leon, in the 1920s, combined two professions at the same time, band leading and bricklaying. Which is odd, because I've always felt that there's a great affinity between those two professions, but I've never been able to convince any band leader. Can't imagine why. Now, when we come to Leon's older brother, Otis, in 1924, having escaped from college with a pharmacy degree, Otis opened a chemist shop and ran it successfully in Los Angeles for 10 years. And it was during those 10 years that he and Leon wrote one big hit. I suppose what happened was that one day Leon paused in the act of laying a brick and decided to drop one instead by writing a sentimental song about his hometown. The Rennes, you see, were children of New Orleans, and as if enough sentimental songs about that place hadn't already been written, they had to go and write another one. Anyway, Leon puts down his bricks, throws his hod aside, and goes round to see Otis, who all this time is busy in the chemist shop making up potions for curing horse bites and all the related diseases resulting from too close contact with song publishers. The brothers write a song, and soon Louis Armstrong, recognizing its possibilities, makes it his own. What I want to know is, while Otis was writing it, who was looking after the shop?
Well,
shining on the fields below. The folks are crooning south in love. You didn't tell me, boy, because I know, yes. When it's sleepy time down south, yes. The south wind blowing the pinewood trees. The folks down there live a life. When old mammy falls on her knees, yes. When it's sleepy time down south, yes. Steamboats up the river coming and going. Yeah, Tanto says, splashing the night away. Papa, says, oh yes. You hear those banjos ringing, and the folks are singing, and they dance till the break of day. Yeah. Dear old Southland, with this dreamy song, you take me back where I belong, right in my mammy's arm. Bantes, 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 does that work? Good evening, everybody.
When It's Sleepy Time Down South, written by Leon and Otis Rene and adopted as his theme song by Louis Armstrong. Now, this next one I often play when the subject of Louis comes up. It's just about the nearest thing you can get to a Louis Armstrong commercial song. Louis is, of course, credited with hundreds of compositions, but none of them is ever likely to be performed by singers of standard songs. Actually, I'm not sure that this one is either, because the lyric, as my colleague Humphrey Littleton has pointed out, means absolutely nothing at all. And yet the way Louis sings it, it does become moving. As for the melody, again, when Louis plays it, we can find in it whatever qualities of musicianship lie within ourselves.
You are, you know. Your friends had you to make me sing another song. Though good luck may be with you, but though your future days be clear, yeah, there won't be another to treat you like a brother. Yeah, some days are rainy days.
That's it. See you same time next week.
You've been listening to In the Benny Green Archives here on lgradio.online. Please do visit the website to find out when the next episode is on, along with all our other shows. This is lgradio.online. Thanks for listening.